here amidst Valentine's Day and all kinds of other things going on. The Spokane Symphony has a concert this weekend. They have another major concert in 2 weeks. And in between, as I just mentioned a few minutes ago, they have some Valentine's Week chamber music coming along. But let's live right in the present. And the concert of Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, has a return. And we're pleased to welcome back to Spokane Daniel Hege. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Vern. It's great to be here.
And, I never remember how long ago anything was. When were you here?
I believe it was 2011, so okay. About 7 years now.
So sounds about right. And coming back to do this concert, which is pretty interesting in the range. Mm-hmm. Name the three composers on this concert.
Well, we're starting with Bach. His second orchestral suite features Bruce Bodden on flute. And the second piece on the program is Shostakovich's Opus 110A Chamber Symphony, which is actually a string orchestration of the 8th String Quartet. Mm-hmm. And on the second half of the program is Beethoven's 5th Symphony, the calling card of classical music in a way. Everyone knows the piece.
Sure. Well, we'll double back around at Shostakovich and Beethoven, but... and we're about to hear some Bach, but... I'm going to just jump ahead to predict, what's it going to feel like to go from Bach to Shostakovich in that first half?
Well, it's a pretty stark difference. We're skipping a couple of centuries there at least, and so the style will be much different, and of course the tonal language will be much different. But it's interesting because Shostakovich actually uses techniques that Bach uses in fugal writing. So when we talk about a musical subject or a musical motif that can be used and developed, Shostakovich does that, and Beethoven does too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you use the famous four notes or something like that. So there are some elements that are common between them, but mm-hmm. of course we have a widely divergent kind of harmonic language that we hear between Bach and Shostakovich.
Sure. Well, again, we'll move back to that. The good news is that Bruce Bodden, who's the soloist for the Bach Second Suite, is with us, as is the pianist Stephen Radcliffe. And so we're going to go to our studio and hear the hit tune, the Badinery,
yes.
from the Bach Second Suite. So here they are. Bruce Bodden, the flutist, Stephen Radcliffe, the pianist, and a little bit of Bach. And from our studio, the Bach Second Suite, the Badinery, the famous movement that is often done as a freestanding piece, played by the soloist for this weekend's concerts, principal flutist of the Spokane Symphony, Bruce Bodden, along with pianist Stephen Radcliffe. And so, so Bruce, thank you. And Stephen, thank you. We appreciate that. Is this kind of one of the Just the basic flute things that every flutist starts with at about, age 15 and the eighth or ninth grade and plays the rest of your life?
Yes, as a matter of fact. My first memories of that piece are actually from James Galway's first recording, The Man with the Golden Flute. And so I went to my teacher and said, "Ooh, I want to play that." And she kind of rolled her eyes and went, "Okay." And that was, I think it was seventh grade, and I was not really ready for it.
But it probably didn't hurt you.
No, it didn't. So that's early early contests, solo and ensemble, trying out for Allstate, that kind of thing. That was always a required piece somewhere along the lines. So.
Yeah. And are there unique challenges in that movement, or is it just kind of the challenges of playing all Bach pieces?
Well, of course, there's the challenges of Bach in general, which mostly have to do with breathing, because he doesn't seem to have thought of the flute as a wind instrument.
Or singers as needing breath either.
Right. Yeah. But that's actually the only movement of the piece that's actively virtuosic. You do a lot of playing in the rest of the piece, but you don't show off very much.
Mm-hmm.
And some people like to play that movement super fast because finally, here's a chance for me to show what I can do. I'm not really like that. Just thinking about what's going to sound good as a tempo.
Well, and let's bring Daniel back into this, too. Let's talk about the rest of the piece. Let's talk about the expressive aspects of the piece and, beyond the famous hit tune movement. What does either of you want to say about the expressiveness of the beautiful piece?
Well, there was a tradition in the Baroque period to be writing some of these French overtures, in the style of French overture, which in the very beginning has this kind of double-dotted, regal, kind of magisterial quality to it, which is very short. And then after that, it usually breaks into a set of dances, so popular Baroque dances. And it was an extremely popular form to compose for. I mean, Telemann wrote hundreds of them. And so it's almost surprising that Bach, who was so prolific, only wrote four of these. But he did these four kind of separate suites, and this one, of course, for flute. So we start with that overture, that double-dotted kind of quality, and then we get into the very first subject, which is still part of the first movement, which is probably the most complex movement in terms of its contrapuntal lines coming together. And that's something we have to work to make sure we hear the subject and the busyness of the texture that all comes together. And then after that, we hear a series of other dances, sometimes in triple meter, sometimes still in duple meter. I think the audience will actually recognize a lot of the other movements, even besides the Bedenry.
Yeah. And talk a little bit more about that balance issue with Bach, because when he gets real busy, how do you solve that? Do you solve it with a lot of editing and markings within the parts that you send ahead? Do you solve it with just style within the rehearsal process? How do you take that on?
It's mostly the style within the rehearsal process. And so I think it's interesting a lot of times if you have the rehearsal time to actually speak with the musicians so they actually understand rather than just kind of following in a kind of robotic sense of looking at a dynamic and saying, oh, I'm supposed to play softer here, but have a kind of understanding of the function of the music. For example, when you're finished playing the subject, which is maybe three or four bars long, that you retreat just a little bit and you play with even maybe a sharper kind of articulation so that the sound is heard but that the actual volume is lower. And so we work to refine that as much as possible. It takes some work to get that to happen. We also try to go for contrasts because, as you know, in the Baroque period, there weren't a lot of dynamic markings in the parts. There's very little information. By the time you get to Mahler on the opposite extreme, every single note has a dynamic and a crescendo, decrescendo, and there's lots of information. So if you simply follow it, you're getting closer to the composer's intentions. With Baroque music and even in classical music, it's left to the interpreters to figure out, how am I going to make this different? How can I create contrast here? Should I be more expressive here or less expressive here? Maybe I should crescendo this one, diminuendo this one. And these are some of the conversations that Bruce and I have been having about the work. And we discuss it and we say, oh, that's a great idea. Let's try it. And then we do it with the orchestra and we try to create that color and variety.
And Bruce, have you done this with in an orchestral setting before?
I have not.
Really?
I've... I think this is my 28th season, and we've never played this piece. Mm-hmm. I did play the Badinery once at a Parks concert a long time ago. I don't even remember what park it was. That's the only time we've done this piece or any part of it.
Yeah. And so did you rehearse it last night? You've been here all week, so you've already rehearsed it.
And Daniel's been great because he scheduled it on every rehearsal.
Nice.
Which is really nice. Normally we only rehearse with the soloist the night before and the morning of the concert. But I'm not a touring soloist who does this kind of thing all the time, so it's been really great to have a chance to get used to standing in front of the orchestra and instead of just being safely hidden within it.
Well, if I may opine, then to make music making a real in learning, growing process rather than kind of cut and dried, okay, this is how I did it last night in Tucson, and this is what we do, and that's it.
Well, and I also think something like the Bach, just because of some of the other reasons we've talked about, it actually needs time to gestate. You know, it isn't like, you know, if you're doing a Rachmaninoff piano concerto, I mean, the orchestra knows that. The pianist is used to being on the circuit. You put it together. You can certainly refine things pretty quickly in two rehearsals. But Bach is not quite that way. Mm-hmm. He's not such an obvious composer in many ways. And so I think evolving with the piece throughout the week. And, of course, the fact that Bruce is local, you know, sometimes it's because the soloist is not even available to come in until the third rehearsal that you have to do that. But Bruce is here. And, yeah, give him a chance, but also give the orchestra a chance so we can, like you said, really make the music throughout the week.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a prosaic question, but when an orchestral member functions as a soloist, do they get time off for good behavior? I guess in a way you do because the Shostakovich is a string.
Only strings,
piece,
yes.
So then there's that. And then do you return to play the Beethoven Fifth?
Yeah, they didn't require me to do that. I could have had time off for good behavior, but they asked me back in the spring when they asked if I would play this, they asked, would you be willing to play the Beethoven? And I said, sure. Mm-hmm. It's a great piece, and contrary to perception, we don't perform it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I said, sure, why not? And now I'm kind of thinking, would I say that now? Well,
always that question. Well, it's I think it's way about time that you were a soloist with the symphony. So we'll really look forward to that. Thanks a lot, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bruce Baden. And thank you, Stephen, for playing with him. Daniel Nykl will continue and talk about Beethoven and Shostakovich. And so you earlier, Daniel, mentioned the sense of motto or thematic stuff, that there are really ways that these three pieces do hold together on this concert, don't they?
Yeah, they really do. And the greatest composers have used very economical music material, you know. In fact, it's a very German way of thinking. So Bach did it, and also Beethoven with the famous four notes, the four note theme in the Fifth Symphony. But interestingly, Shostakovich, while I don't think he was necessarily taking a cue, we don't know, of course, his inspiration exactly. But he uses his famous signature of the D-S-C-H, pom pom pim pom, and so that little musical motif is pervasive through the entire 20-minute work of the Shostakovich. And I'll actually explain that to the audience a little bit during the concert, just so they can actually hear those notes and know that it is connecting everything together. But I think that piece works on so many levels, but that is how I think it is, has a common thread with Beethoven.
When I think of the Shostakovich Eighth Quartet, I think it's one of the best entry-level Shostakovich pieces, isn't it? Because when I had the youth orchestra, I know that the high school kids, boy, the minute they found the Shostakovich Eighth, they were head over heels.
I couldn't agree more. I think for people who, sometimes there's a certain bias out there, which I don't comprehend, against Shostakovich. Because I think of Shostakovich as being able to speak so directly and viscerally and communicate so deeply and emotionally with people. And I think this piece is a piece that would be a great example of that. Because right away you're taken in with these textures that are just, they're just truly beautiful. And you can hear the mourning in it. You can hear the passion, you can hear the visceral, almost like a, it's almost cinematic in some ways. It has very aggressive music, it has very lonely music, but it's something that while it's something he experienced, and you talked about, you know, doing away with fascism, and of course maybe he was really thinking about Stalin instead. I mean, we have all the other subtext that goes with it. If you simply just listen to the music, you feel the humanity in the music, and that's what I think connects to everybody.
And does it? I know it much more as the quartet than as the chamber music, chamber orchestra version. Does it kind of feel the same both ways?
Certainly the themes are the same, so the musical material is the same overall. And sometimes with the string quartet version, you can take faster tempos. Like, for example, the second tempo, the second movement, which is very, very fast. You can take it a little bit faster because the strings speak, you know, just together. And when you have the collective sound, I think in a big hall, it just doesn't work at that kind of tempo. So the difference, though, in the arrangement for full string orchestra versus the quartet is that Rudolf Barschai, who arranged the string orchestra version, he revoiced a lot of the chords so that instead of just saying, okay, here's the first violin part, second violin, you know, just handing it out, and here's the double bass part, just to play with the cello sometimes, that would be a very boring and dull way to arrange it. He instead takes some of the second violin part and he voices it way up high in the cello part. Mm. So it has a completely different timbre when the cellos are up there kind of screaming really high and the violas are up above the seconds sometimes in range. And sometimes the first violins are playing lower than the cellos. So he's done things so that it is a completely different kind of just sonority in the orchestra. And by writing a lot of divisi, you know, divisi just means divided strings, so that you can hear the chord more fully, so that you can increase the range and the thickness of the texture. And I think Barschai did an expert job in doing that because it really comes off in a great way.
Nice. And then your complete history with the Beethoven Fifth Symphony from the first moment you heard it to now. Go ahead.
Oh boy. Okay. Here we go. How much time do we have? I mean that there's something about the Fifth Symphony that where Beethoven, as he did with basically every piece I think I've ever heard of Beethoven, he finds a certain rightness in the way he is able to find, as I mentioned earlier, the most economical amount of material, the briefest, shortest motive or phrase, and then exploiting that and developing it into everything it can be and more. And not only that, but the way he uses form and structure in a very dramatic way. He knows just how many bars to do of this before it changes to this, and which harmony should it go to? Well, it should go to that. And when you hear it, you're thinking, there is no other possible way. I've seen a Bernstein video where he actually has found some of the old sketches of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and he plays them on the piano, and he has the orchestra play some of those sketches. He had them orchestrated. And he explains how, well, this is good, but listen to what he actually did. And then when you hear those things side by side, you realize how Beethoven, his hard work at trying to get something exactly right, there is a rightness to it. And it has to do with the drama. What are we expecting next? What is unexpected? And where is it going to pull us in further? I mean, the first movement has a propulsive feel like no other work does. And I think the reason it's so successful is because people hear the overt dramatic energy, but I think there's something in their mind that's also working with their heart because they know that it's just those few motifs, just those few notes that's pulling everything together. I mean, Beethoven, like a lot of German thinkers, not only just in music, but certainly in music, it's as though you handed him a brick and said, now build a cathedral out of this. And he did. He did. He took one brick, this pa-pa-pa-pum, and he built an entire symphony. Because even in the other movements, you can hear that rhythmic pulse of the three notes going to the fourth note.
Is there a basic consistency in your lifetime approach to this, or do you get revelations?
I do get some revelations here and there. I guess it's always continually refining. Because it actually, just like Bruce said earlier about the Benari, is one of the pieces that you learn early and it's required playing. The Fifth Symphony, first movement of Beethoven, is required for every young conductor to learn and do with an orchestra. So I've done it for a long time. But I do have different ideas. I've done the opening in different ways based on what's there. He doesn't ask for a break after the pa-pa-pa-pum and then break, pa-pa-pa-pum. But that's how I did it for a long time, and that's how I heard a lot of other conductors do it. And you can just decide, well, maybe it's better to not do that. Go, ba-ba-ba-ba, straight in, ba-ba-ba-ba. And the other big moments toward the end of the first movement where it slows down, why? So I've rethought some of those things. And also just trying to adjust balances so that certain things that I've never heard before, I really think they should come out. Mm. So I like to work with the textures. And I always go back to the score. I always just look at the score. I don't listen to recordings anymore. I just say, what did Beethoven leave? And that's what I want to hear. So,
along the way, did you encounter Gunther Schiller's analysis of it, from his Complete Conductor?
Oh, I have seen that. Yeah. I have seen that. Yeah, it's very interesting. That is extremely analytical. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's amazing in how he puts a microscope over every bar of that piece.
Well, I think what I've always liked about composers as conductors, somehow it seems like they can understand why more than the rest of us non-composers can.
I think you're right. A composer always has to make choices. And so when you look at what choice they made, then you wonder, oh, okay. Yeah, and it kind of dawns on you. And maybe that's why this video I saw of Bernstein talking about it was very interesting, because he could actually play it and show why this works and why this doesn't.
So. And Daniel Hagey, the conductor who's conducting the symphony on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at the Fox, what's another fun thing you're doing here in coming months, or exciting project or piece that you're captivated by right now?
Oh, boy. I've got so much coming up. I'm doing Mahler 4th in Tulsa soon, and Elgar in the South, which I've never done before. John Adams, Chairman Dances, which I've never done before. So I like doing a lot of American music, a lot of big symphonic music. Mahler 7th is another one, and that's a piece that's near and dear to my heart. So I like doing the very large orchestra pieces, but I go from Bach to Mahler and modern music as well. Next week I'm doing music of Roberta Sierra, Fandangos, and we're doing the Barber Violin Concerto, and we're doing a Candide suite of Leonard Bernstein.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah, because, you know, everyone goes to West Side Story, which is great also, and the overture to Candide. But now we're doing this suite. It's really nice, a Charlie Harmon arrangement of it. It's very symphonic and beautiful. So it's, you know, it's the Bernstein centenary this year. So, you know, there are a lot of interesting things. I have a huge range in the repertoire, so I love it all.
Great. Daniel Hagey, who guest conducting the Spokane Symphony Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. Thanks for coming around.
Thank you, Vern.